my God. I'm Maggie. I'm an alcoholic. I am nervous. Thank you for having me to the group that organizes speakers. I'm honored to be here. I'm thrilled to be sober. I cannot believe it's been 28 years since the day I walked in here. And today is actually my AA birthday. Al and I were talking about it. He said, pick a date in August. And I said, no, you pick any Saturday in August is fine with me. And he said, how about the 23rd? And I said, that's perfect. And I told him, I said, it's my AA birthday. And he said, you'd be surprised how many people end up speaking on their actual birthday. And so I just feel like it was, you know, a gift on my birthday, along with 28 years. I'm going to try, 28 years, I actually have been sober longer than I was alive before I, you know, got sober. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about, you know, what I was like and what happened. But I'm going to try and talk more about what it's like now and how I work the steps. I apologize in advance for people who go to meetings with me regularly, because that's all I've got is the same stuff I talk about in the meetings, especially the people that go to my 12-step group, because, you know, they're going to hear the same crap they've heard all before. But, you know, it's what I've got. And I like to do this early, because when I'm listening to a speaker, I'm always trying to do the math. So I was born in 1956 in September. I got sober in 1980 in August, so that makes me now 51. I'll be 52 in September, and I'll have 28 years today. So I was just shy of my 24th birthday when I got sober. I was young, but I was done. My home group is Monday Night Women's Let Go and Let God, right here in San Carlos, close by here. I go, unless I am dying or traveling, I am in that meeting. And I go to other meetings. I go to a step study. And 28 years later, I'm still doing it. I talk about it all the time. If you have trouble finding a power greater than yourself, go to a meeting, because he goes to every single one. And I honestly believe that. When I'm having trouble making a conscious contact, I can go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can always find a power greater than myself. That's the first power I ever had greater than myself, was Alcoholics Anonymous. I grew up pretty average family, actually pretty normal, you know, up until about 9 when my parents divorced. But you know, I was raised in a family, mother and dad both there. My parents expected us to be honest and work hard and go to school and, you know, do the right thing and know the right from wrong. I remember feeling when I went to school the first time, public school, that other kids, their parents had gone to a meeting before school started and they'd gotten a book and they had been told what to do, and I didn't get the book. My parents didn't go to the meeting. That's how I felt. I felt like I had not gotten the rules, whatever those rules were, and other kids had it, and I didn't. And, I mean, that's, you know, I was 5 or 6 years old, and I already felt different. And that was years before I took my first drink. And I struggled with that all the way until I took my first drink, obviously. And then it kind of was alleviated for a while. My mother was an alcoholic. She knew she had a problem with drinking, and she tried desperately to control it, so she was a periodic. She would go on weekend binges. And my father suffered from mental illness. And so by the time I got here, I honestly was convinced that I was either, you know, an alcoholic or mentally ill or both. And I was actually kind of relieved when I found out that I was an alcoholic, because I had seen my mother get sober and I knew there was a solution. I didn't like the solution. The spiritual thing was not for me. I didn't like it at all. It made me very uncomfortable, but I liked the meetings. I liked the people. And when I finally hit my bottom, I was willing to come and try this higher power thing. I took my first drink. I was probably about 13. I went to summer camp. And I remember I'd gone to my aunt's house. She had a full bar, And I took a 16-ounce Coke bottle with a resealable cap, and I took a little out of every bottle on the bar. And, you know, so there was, and she had all kinds of, you know, brandies, like blackberry brandies and fancy wines and scotches and gin. Of course, when you put all that together, it all tastes like scotch. At least that's, you know, that's what I remember, because I could never drink scotch again. I put it in my suitcase, and the following week I went to summer camp, and I drank it. And I mean, I couldn't stand the taste. I grew up in a family where drinking was very popular, very common. Everybody drank, and we had a few alcoholics. So I knew that it would be good if I could drink it, but it tasted terrible. So I basically, you know, chugged it. And then, so on my first drink, I learned that, you know, you immediately can get sick, and if you throw up, you know, if you have long hair, you got to put it in a ponytail, or you get, you know, in your hair, you know, throw up all over it. I also learned on my first drink that, you know, the room can spin. If you take your foot out and hang it and put it on the floor, it's better. I mean, you know, 13. and, you know, I was terrified they were going to catch me at camp. And I really don't remember much else about that week at camp. You know, I don't know. I know I woke up the next morning. So I drank, I threw up, I spun, I fell asleep. And, you know, I didn't think anything was that unusual. The next time I remember drinking, I went to a drive-in with a boy. And, you know, he had Boone's Farm apple wine. You talk about it. And he had a Chevelle. And I threw up all over. It was white. And I threw up all over the side of it, you know. Somewhere in there, I started smoking pot, and I know this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and but I did do a lot of drugs and alcohol, snorted a lot of things, smoked a lot of things. I didn't use any needles, and I credit drugs for getting me here at a young age. I mean, I believe I could have drank like that for years, and my mother did, late into her 40s, and maybe I wouldn't, you know, have gotten here as young as I did, but the drugs really took me places that, you know, I didn't want to be. And so, you know, I'm starting to drink, I'm starting to drug, and 15, I meet him, my first husband, married him at 17 because I'd slept with him, you know. After once you sleep with him, you had to marry him. That's what I believed, so I did. I married him at 17, and that didn't last. Lasted a couple months. I moved back home. But while I was dating him, I had a sister, an older sister, who started, you know, using drugs. She actually was the first person that ever got me high, and she started having mental breaks with reality. And eventually, she was committed. And my mother had to have her committed to an institution. And while she was there, she was killed by two other patients. I was 17, and I was already starting to party, and I knew there was something similar about her to me, but I didn't think it would happen to me. You know, when you're 17, you don't think so. About 4 or 5 years later, I had an older brother who was also using and drinking, and he committed suicide under the influence. And I didn't think it would happen to me. Somewhere a couple months after that, my mother finally decided to get sober. So now I'm 21, okay, and I'm skipping over a lot. All the drinking, all the drugging, sleeping, you know, using drugs to assuage the guilt I felt for being promiscuous. And, you know, that's what I was doing. And my mother got sober. And I went to meetings to watch her take a cake. I watched her take her first cake, and I thought, this is really cool. I really liked this meeting that she was in. But then they started doing the prayer stuff. You know, they said the Lord's Prayer at the end, and I was like, okay. You know, I don't believe in God. I don't believe in God. I had been raised in a church, and the church was a decent church. I didn't learn to be afraid of God. I just didn't buy it. I just didn't believe. And I've come to believe now that I chose not to believe because I felt guilty about the behavior. I knew drinking and drugging was wrong. I knew sleeping around was wrong. I knew being unfaithful to anybody else, you know, to my husband was wrong. But so I couldn't have a God, because then you have to be accountable to somebody. So I chose not to believe anymore. So I went to this meeting, and I remember I went a couple of times, and I went to some Al-Anon meetings, and I remember my mother, they asked me if I'd share, you know, what we do to people who bring their kids or their, you know, would you like to share? And, you know, I'm like 21, and I'm like, this is really nice. I'm really happy for my mother. And, you know, out of my mouth comes, I think I might have an alcoholic personality. Where the hell did that come from? I was stunned. It's like, I don't know how come I said that. And, well, you know, I knew. I mean, and that was really true. Something about being with you guys, I had to tell the truth. And because you knew. I felt like you already looked right at me and knew, so I may as well tell you. But I wasn't done drinking. I still thought that I could control and enjoy it myself. And so she had probably 2 years of sobriety, and I was dating a guy who was starting to smack me around. And I called her up and said, Mom, you know, I can't live like this anymore. And she said, I'll put a plane ticket at the airport, get on an air. You know, she lived in San Diego. I was living in Maryland. She said, come out and visit me. I said, okay. So I got on the plane. My mother lived in Poway. This is 28 years ago. There was nothing going on in Poway at night. On, you know, at nothing. I mean, none of those roads went through like they do today. There was Poway Road and there was Pomerado, and they turned off the lights at dark, you know. And she went to a meeting every single night. That's all she did. And so if I wanted to go out, I went to a meeting. So I came here in, like, you know, late July, early August, and 3 weeks of going to meetings. I probably went to 3 or 4 meetings a week, and the people were the same nice people. And I was at a meeting up in San Isabel on a Saturday night, and it's still there, I think, at Dudley's. And I'd gone 3 weeks in a row. This was my third week. And I heard a man share. And I didn't have anything in common with him in terms of age or, you know, he was a guy and he was, you know, much older than I was. And I didn't recognize his story at all until he said that for every, you know, 2 steps forward, he felt like he'd take, or for every step forward he tried to take in life, you know, his drugs and alcohol had pulled him back too. And that hit home. I knew that that was my story, you know, that my life was going nowhere and I was done trying. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll try this Alcoholics Anonymous thing. And I also knew that that meant I had to try a power greater than myself. And I'd heard enough in the meetings to know that you can use Alcoholics Anonymous as your power greater than yourself, and so that's what I decided. For a few months, I used AA as my power greater than myself, and it worked. I'd never been able to say no when somebody sidled up to me and said, do you party? You know, I mean, and people always did. I mean, it's funny how almost immediately after I got sober, that stopped happening. I mean, really, it did. It was like the most amazing thing. You know, but up until then, you know, everybody asked me, and I never said no. I always said yes, and I always went. I didn't have to know you. I didn't have to like you. But if you had something I wanted, you know, I was going to go. And I ended up in some pretty ugly places as a result. And I went to that meeting, and I remember my mom, I was with my mother and a couple of her friends. And, you know, she was probably in her 50s by then, my age now. And I said to her, you know, I think I might be an alcoholic. And she was stunned. She had no idea. And she said, really? And I said, yeah, I think I might belong. And she said, okay, do you want to go to a meeting tomorrow night? And I said, yeah. And so she told her friends that we were with, and they were all, you know, welcome aboard, and don't worry about it. It doesn't matter if you don't have a power greater than yourself. You'll figure it out. Just keep coming back. And that's what I did. And 28 years later, I'm still doing that. I just keep coming back. You know, I don't speak a lot from the podium. It's not one of the things that has come up a lot in my sobriety. So I don't have a canned pitch. I'm going to tell you a little bit about how I work the steps. And I'm going to jump around because I was thinking this morning about how did I work the steps. And some stories fit that came up at 18 years and other stories fit that came up at 2 years and some at 9 months and some at 2 days. And so I'm just going to tell you the stories and how they kind of worked. For me, I talked about it earlier. You know, for me, I could tell my life was unmanageable and that I was an alcoholic. I was really kind of relieved because I had watched my mother get sober and I knew there was a solution. I didn't think it would work for me because I wasn't willing to believe in God, but I was relieved to know that I was not mentally ill like my father. He really struggled with mental illness. And, you know, I had a sister who had struggled, the one who died, with mental illness. So I was pretty relieved at that. The unmanageability was pretty clear to me. You know, I had, you know, I was 23 years old and my best shot had got me into Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, how else, you know, I was not very manageable. Step two, came to believe. That was more of a process for me. Because I had to kind of do this, I'm going to believe in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I kind of made it a science experiment. I like the part in the book where it talks about, you know, we trust electricity, we just turn the light on, you know, we scientific people. I thought I was really intellectual, so you know, I did the science experiment. I said, you know, I'm going to believe in God until I get drunk, and I'm still doing it. You know, I mean, really, that is really how it worked for me. I kind of did the fake it till you make it thing. I pretended I believed, and I kept coming to meetings. And I somewhere along the way realized that I had been staying sober, and it had been easy to do. And God had completely removed the obsession, and I couldn't take any credit for it. You know, there was no counting the hours or worrying about the days. And I know it doesn't happen that way for everybody. I know for some people it's a long time before the obsession is removed. But for me, I looked back and went, when did it happen? I couldn't tell, but it had been relatively easy. And for me, that looking and being willing to look for God was all I needed, and it still is to this day. I like the part in the book where it talks about resign from the debating society. I mean, I have done some reading about spirituality and religions and things like that, but I really don't need to know anymore. God put me here, and that's all I need. Everything else is frosting on this cake. The minute I try to make it more complicated and put some rules around it and try to fit it in, I start to wonder if there really is a God and which one's the right one, and I have to remind myself that Alcoholics Anonymous is a power greater than me, and it works, and I don't need to know how it works. Somewhere along in here, I started to realize that there were these steps and that I was going to have to do a fourth step. So I knew I was going to need a sponsor. Somehow I had learned that. I was going to meetings. I went to a meeting every single day because that's what my mother did. I didn't have a car, so I went with her. And we went to a meeting every day except for Tuesday nights. There was no Tuesday night meeting in Poway or Rancho Bernardo at the time. And so I had a woman who I didn't know what to do about a sponsor. So I went to a meeting and I said, I don't know what to do about a sponsor. And they said, oh, we'll have the topic be on sponsorship tonight. So while they were sharing, there was a woman who said, you know, when I sponsor, I try to be humble and I just knew. I knew God had spoken. You know, she'd spoken to me, so I asked her to be my sponsor. Went up to her. I said, will you be my sponsor? She said, yes. She said, do you want to work the steps? And I was like, right away. And pretty much that was what we did. I mean, she'd say to me after the meeting, what are you doing about your steps? And I would tell her. And when it came to the third step, she said, I mean, we didn't have real elaborate, long meetings. It would be like 10 minutes after the meeting. She'd say, have you worked step one? And I'd be like, I think so. She'd say, I do too. Okay, how about two? You know, she saw me in a meeting every day, so she knew I kind of had done one and two. Same thing with two. You know, have you worked two? And I said, I think so. She said, so do I. Okay, how about three? I mean, that's how I worked one, two, and three, I have to say. I had less than 90 days. Third step. She said, have you turned your life over? And I said, I don't know. And she said, have you made a decision that you want to? And I said, yes. She said, that's good enough. Now you're working on four. And I was like, are you kidding? She said, that's all you need. We don't have time for all this, you know, worrying about whether or not it's right. And, you know, she's kind of old school. She believed that, you know, that's, you had to move along and you needed to get through it. So I said, what do I do? And she said, just start writing. I didn't have a clue, you know, what that meant. And I would sit down at night and I would try to write and I couldn't think of anything. But at work during the day, by now I've gotten a job, and at work during the day, I would think of things. I'd be like, oh, crap, I got to remember to write that down tonight. Well, I'd get home and I couldn't remember what it was. What was that? So I started carrying pieces of paper and a pen with me at work. And so when I think of it, and so if you're working step four and you're having trouble, I highly recommend this method because it worked for me. And eventually one day I knew I was done. I would think of something at work and I would write down, you know, forgot to do this or wanted to do this or screwed this guy over or whatever it was. And I'd write it down just enough to remember it. I'd stick it in my pocket. And when I got home that night, I'd take it out and I'd write about it. And it really worked for me. And that's how I worked the fourth step the first time. Since then, now, you know, I work the fourth step lots of different ways. Sometimes I come home angry at someone, or I realize that I'm struggling, or I'm depressed, or I'm, you know, whatever it is, and I will sit down and I get 15 minutes and I will write about it. And but I write a lot more now. I write in the mornings. The fifth step, you know, one of those things about the fifth step is that you have to do it with someone else, and that's what scared me. And I didn't want to do that at all. But I knew that I wanted to be, I was kind of an overachiever and I wanted to belong here. I really wanted to get up here someday and say I had 28 years. I mean, at 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, I wanted to be able to say someday I have 10 years or I have 20 years or I have 30 years. And I knew I couldn't do it if I didn't work step five. And I get really emotional about that because I do feel that step five is, you know, as they say, this is the one that separates the men from the boys. Or the girls from the women, I don't know. You know, that's when you really share with another person. That's when I have to tell you the truth. And for me, step five was, you know, scary. I went up to her house, you know, and her husband comes out. And she had like 16 years, he had 18 years. And he said, are you going to start your fourth? And I said, yeah. He says, well, let me go in the other room and start the tape recorder. And I was like... And she said, he's kidding, dear. And I was like, and, you know, I mean, I was so impressionable that I really thought that's what he, I, you know, I was like, so, you know, and once I realized he was joking, I was okay with it. And I spent, you know, several hours with her, and I told her my story. And I really didn't, my first inventory was a moral inventory, all of the things I felt I had done wrong, all of the dishonest things I had done, immoral things I had done. I didn't even know what a character defect was yet. I mean, I hadn't even thought about being selfish or being self-centered or having resentments. It was all about, you know, feeling like I was dirty. And I told her all about it. I started with the worst part. And she fed me apple pie afterwards. And kind of, you know, I remember she lived in Ramona, and I remember leaving her house, and I felt different, but I didn't have this like immediate feeling of weight coming off me, but I felt like I have done something good, and it was like a little tiny glow that started, and as I drove down the hill, I felt better, and as the weekend went on, I felt even better, and over the next few weeks, I began to really feel like I had made a commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous and to this way of life. And, you know, I couldn't believe how great I felt. And all that crap, I had left it there. For whatever reason, I knew I never had to worry about that again. And quite honestly, I never have. There were, you know, obviously, I didn't talk about a lot of things. You know, my parents, I really didn't talk about much. But I did everything I knew at the moment. And... And then, you know, comes step six. And my sponsor told me that she thought, you know, I would, you know, you can do step six. You can kind of work it. Well, we probably spend more time on step six in our sobriety than anywhere else. Because you got to feel your character defects before you can really want to get rid of them. And, you know, that's where the pain is. You know, that's where the discomfort is coming to terms with what your character defects are and, you know, and then getting entirely ready to get rid of them. And for me, you know, my character defects, I was, you know, I'm still finding them. Things that I thought I was good at and that were my strengths, you know, I'm ashamed to even admit that I do it, you know, now. But at the time, I thought they were great. So six and seven are steps for me that I spend a lot of time in. And it's not by choice. It's because that's the way the process seems to work. I like to keep it pretty simple. So I always tell people that I sponsor, you know, trust God, clean house, work with others. And the cleaning house is always the part. I mean, nobody likes to clean house. That's why we hire housekeepers. But you can't hire a housekeeper for this job. You can ask your sponsor to help you. You can ask your spouse. You can ask your friends. You can, but you got to do the work. And I didn't like that. And I've come to be more willing because I do like a clean house. It's amazing how good that feels. So, where am I? 7. You know, being entirely ready and then asking God. You know, the trick about asking God is, when you're asking God to remove your shortcomings, you're asking Him to remove the ones that are in His way, not necessarily in your way. And that's the hard part, because I want the ones that are making me uncomfortable out. And that's not really what step 7 is about. It's about asking God to remove those things which remove me from or make me not useful to Him. And so I don't always get a vote on which ones He removes. And I've not always liked that. And, you know, I step 7 has meant for me trying to allow God to do it because I can't. And I don't like that much. I'm going to move on to step 8 because I've kind of lost my train of thought here. step 8, you know, you have to make a list. And for me, as I said, I didn't do a very thorough 4 step the first time. I did as thorough as I could, but, you know, so much more was going to be revealed later on. And, like, my dad had mental illness, and my parents divorced at 9. My mother was very kind to my father and to us about my father. She always said he was a sick man. She never badmouthed him. She never said unkind things. But somewhere I was resentful that I had not had a dad. And I knew from being in meetings for years. I mean, my dad died when I was 20 years sober, 18 years sober, something like that. And I knew that I was resentful that I couldn't voice it because I felt like guilty for having a resentment against a person who couldn't help the way he was. And if my mother could be that kind to him, why couldn't I? And I could not forgive him. And I worked at it. I talked about it. I made noise about it, you know, that I had forgiven him and I understood. And but truth of the matter was I hadn't. And what one of the gifts was when he did die, he was living on a VA pension in Pennsylvania, in Stroudsburg. And he had this little tiny, you know, studio place that was public assistance, paid for it. And he had pretty much lost touch with reality. He was 80 or so, and he had a heart attack and died. And my sister and I went to his place and to clean up. I had not seen him in 60 years. And not 60 years. I hadn't seen him. I hadn't been alive 60. I hadn't seen him in probably, I don't know, 30 years. And I got to read. His mental illness kind of had a lot of facets. One of them was he was kind of OCD, and he labeled everything. And he labeled everything, like every tape dispenser. And he had 8 or 9 of them in this studio place. He had scissors, and he had, you know, like he had every, his cornstarch was labeled when the last time he used it was on his shelf. And he wrote, he journaled every day. And he talked about the fact that he had a family and that his mental illness had prevented him from being the father he knew he needed to be. And he had chosen to stay out of our lives because he felt that was the most loving thing, because his mental illness was so overwhelming to him and he knew it would be to us. And, you know, those are the kinds of gifts that you get in sobriety if you stick around and you stay open, because it took 20 years for me to get that revelation. And I was able to forgive him I was able to be grateful to him for being the father, the best father he could be. So, you know, for me, I couldn't even get him on the list of amends. So God got him there for me. And I have a similar story with my mother. You know, this is step 9. You know, I had a resentment about her because, you know, she hadn't been the mother I thought she should be. Now, she was a drunk like us, and we were going to meetings together. So I couldn't really admit that to myself or even to a sponsor or to her. I mean, who could say, this wonderful woman who is now sober, you know, I think you weren't a very good mother. And, you know, I'm 8 years sober, and I have my first child in the bedroom. And I suddenly wake up in the middle of the night, and I'm terrified that I'm not going to be a good enough parent. And I realize that, you know, in the bed next to me is my husband, and that between us and this program and God, I will be an adequate parent. And like a lightning bolt, it strikes me that my mother had this thought in the middle of the night, too. But she wasn't sober yet, and she was single. And I was overwhelmed by the concept that I had not ever thought that she might feel like I felt. And so my mother's still alive at that point, and she's sober. And so I get up in the middle of the night, and I start writing. And I make a list of everything about me that is good that my mother might have had a part in. And this is one of my favorite things. If everything that is wrong with me was my mother's fault, then everything that's good about me is her fault as well. And I suddenly had this realization that, you know, I could do lots of things. I'd finished school. I could cook. I could turn a bed. I could show up for work on time. There were all kinds of things I could do. I could ask for help. I was in this program. I mean, the fact that I was in this program was because she had been in the meetings. And so I had this real revelation, and I went to a meeting. And I got up in front of the meeting, and my mother was there, and I made amends to her. And I said, you know, I am sorry that I had not been able to forgive her. And she was pretty bowled over, and she said, you know, I knew there was tension between us, but I didn't know what was causing it. And so, you know, from that day forward, my mother lived another, I don't know if I was 8 years, she lived another 10 years. Before she finally died. And we were really close after that. And one of the things I learned was that my telling her that I had been able to see where she had helped me in my life, she was able to then forgive her own mother because she had resentments against her own mother and her mother was dead. And so, you know, it was one of those things that making that amends made us right. And, you know, so I can't tell you how this works. It just does. It happens. I just keep coming to meetings. And I say that a lot. I'm married to a guy who has never seen me drink. I've been married 25 years this November. He's never seen me drink. I have both my children. They've never seen me drink. And one of the things that I learned about men is that they're the way God made them. And they're right just the way they are. Now, that's been a pretty recent revelation. I'm serious. I mean, I married him. I spent the first 20 years probably of my marriage trying to make him be more like a girlfriend, you know. Why can't you do it the way I would do it or a woman would do it or my girlfriends would do it? Why can't you do it this way? And one day I suddenly realized that, you know, God made men the way they are, and He was God and I wasn't. And over the years, though, I have to say that whenever I'm struggling with my husband, I go to more meetings and he gets better. That's one of my favorite. You know, I'm serious. If there have been lots of times in my life where I've struggled with something, whether it was work-related, school, children, husband, parents, if I'm struggling, I go to more meetings. And if I'm not going to more meetings, then I'm shortchanging myself. you know, my husband is a really great guy, and he's normie. He really is. He can put down a beer, and I'll watch it for him. It's like, are you going to drink that? No? Why? Well, it's getting warm. He's like, then that's why I'm not going to drink it. Okay? So, you know, I asked him if he wanted to come tonight. He's like, no. But, you know, he knows that meetings come first, and we've had some really great times. I've had years where I really didn't think I'd married the right guy. I was absolutely convinced that, you know, I'd made a mistake. And if I had not had children with him, I'd have been out of there. And now I'm convinced that I'm married to the right guy. And when I married him, on the day I married him, I told him at the altar, I've married you for this day, one day at a time. I'm going to be married to you. And he said, I hope that's going to be like one day at a time for the rest of our lives. And I said, do I have to? No. You know, and really, basically, he knows that this program comes first. And I was telling somebody earlier, you know, when he met me, I went to a meeting every single day. And if you wanted to go out with me, you have to come before the meeting and take me to dinner, come to the meeting with me, or meet me after. I'm not giving up the meeting in between. And, you know, I've had periods of my sobriety where I've let my meetings get low. And it's gotten to the point now where he will say to me, do you want to go to a meeting? it doesn't happen much anymore. I mean, in the years between 15 and 20, I tried to cram 10 pounds into a 5-pound sack. And, you know, I wanted to have it all. And sobriety promised me that if I was willing to work for it, I could have whatever I worked for. The problem is that I've learned you can't necessarily have it all at the same time. So, you know, I'm kind of relaxing a little on that. I have two kids. My youngest is 21. She's a normie. She's just like her dad. You know, Catherine, are you going to drink that? No, it's getting warm. And then I have a son who's in the program. I think he's still sober. You know, he comes and he goes. I think he got this time sober on July 5th. I have had to practice an Al-Anon program. I joined Al-Anon a few years back. I bring him to you and hope you'll fix him. And until he hits his bottom and finds a power greater than himself, you know, I can't be his power greater than himself. Steps 10, 11, and 12. Let's see, 10. Continue to take personal inventory. Oh, yeah. You know, when I talk about I write on a daily basis. I still have a sponsor. She has 41 years of sobriety. I drive up. She took her cake last week. I drove up to Alpine and saw her take a cake. I still call her once a week. You know, I've gone through periods where I didn't use her at all. And I really gypped myself out of the support of a person who just, she's there for me, just for me. And if you don't have a sponsor, you're cheating yourself out of a great opportunity to learn about yourself and to have someone who is just there for you. And if you don't feel that way about your sponsor, you might want to consider getting another one. Because I'm telling you, you should have a sponsor that you feel like is just there for you when you need them. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact. I just recently in the last few months learned that I had stopped praying correctly. I do believe that, you know, you should only pray for knowledge of his will for you and the power to carry it out. And but when my son started having a drug and alcohol problem, I started praying for him to have knowledge of God's will for him and the power to carry it out. And I started to realize that, you know, that really wasn't my job anymore. You know, once he got 18, I'm not responsible for him legally or whatever. And so I'm still learning that, you know, my power greater than myself, I said this at a meeting recently, you know, when I start to understand God, then he's not God anymore. You know, he's got to be something I don't understand. Otherwise, you know, I don't need him. Is that what I said? I don't remember what I said. Step 12. You know, having had a spiritual awakening, and I'm still having them. I mean, that's the best part of this program, is that if you keep working these steps and going to meetings and having a sponsor and sponsoring other people and volunteering, you will continue to have spiritual awakenings. And you know, I sponsor several women, and but I still volunteer to be the secretary or to clean up, be the literature person. 28 years does not make you immune from washing coffee cups if the meeting has cups, because I want the meeting to be here. And, you know, the whole business of carrying this message. Last year, about 2 years ago, I have a pretty good job. I make pretty good money. In the meantime, all this time, I went back to school. I got a graduate degree. I've done really well professionally. And, you know, about 2 years ago, I was talking to my sponsor about I was considering moving jobs. And, you know, the money was good, but I didn't know if I wanted to leave the security where I was, and I liked the company I worked for. And, you know, I really couldn't differentiate whether or not I should leave. And she said to me, "Where can you be of the most service?" And I have to say, you know, I was 26 years sober. I had never thought about a decision like that. Where can I be of the most service? And I thought, you know, it's nice that I'm still learning. You know, that I, at 26 years of sobriety, I can still have one of those aha moments. And so that's what I'm trying to do. I honestly believe that God put me here in Alcoholics Anonymous because this is where he wants me. I have other things, you know, I like to be green, and I'm, you know, I donate to certain charities and everything, but whenever I start worrying about am I doing what God wants me to do, I remember that he put me in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is my job. This is my purpose. And I often talk about, you know, when I first started worrying about, thinking about turning my life over to care of God, I used to worry that one day, if I did that, he would make me a missionary in China. Or, you know, a born-again Christian, and I don't mean to offend anyone who is born again, but, you know, something that I, at that time, could not imagine me ever wanting to do. And then I realized that if it was my purpose, that I would be happy doing it, and that, you know, I didn't need to worry, that God would put me where I would be the most happy. And as I said, he's put me in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I honestly feel that God draws us to him one way or the other, and this is how he got me. And you know, I made some notes because I knew I wouldn't remember things, but I think I've touched just about everything, and I'm getting close to the end here. But this has made me really nervous. There's sweat running down my back. That's going to be on the tape, isn't it? Yeah, streaming live. I didn't tell my husband. You know, he could listen on the internet. Although he knows my story. You know, I don't really have a whole lot. I mean, I've probably got 5 minutes left. I think I'm supposed to go till 9. I don't really know. But, you know, all I know is that I couldn't stop drinking. And I came to you guys, and you told me that if I would just do a few simple things and come to meetings, I could stay sober. And 28 years ago tonight, I made that commitment, and I'm here today. And I didn't finish anything when I got here. Nothing finished in my life. I was always quitting things. I cannot believe it. You could pinch me, you know, and I'd wake up and I'd say, "Oh, it was a dream," because it really has felt like a dream. And I will tell you that if I get to heaven, or if I die, and on my deathbed they say to me, "There really isn't a God," I don't care, because it has kept me sober. Thanks.